So first, EXO results. EXO is a collaboration in one particular double beta decay mode. So what I will present is our work that represents quite a fair amount of people, about 100 collaborators. That includes engineers and techs in about 14 different institutions in 6 different countries. You see the center of gravity is visibly Stanford and Slack. However, Canadians, we form about 20% of the collaboration. So we are a very visible non-minority, I should say. And I think we have a good critical mass in Canada. So the plan is to briefly take as a starting point massive neutrinos and double beta decay, a few reminders if you're not too familiar to the field, what the field now looks like from an experimental point of view. I'll have a few words on nuclear matrix element calculations because they are quite crucial to these measurements. And then what EXO-200 is about, the lab we're at, and what are these results, and what the future looks like for us. So if you look now at the current oscillation data involving neutrinos, that's a graph you can pull off the internet I did a couple days ago, you can see, well, first, there's a lot of work that has been invested into studying neutrino oscillations. That field in particular of neutrino oscillations has been marked with very anomalous, unexpected results. Some of them turn out to be fundamentally true and very important in their significance, in particular solar and atmospheric neutrinos. What is also of interest is that the regions that were covered for first in natural phase space were covered also later on by artificially produced neutrinos. So we have use neutrinos from reactors and from accelerators to verify beams that we have found in nature. And this still has no real clear correspondence with the quark sector. So we can decompose the mixing matrix into the following submatrices that represent more or less the mixing angles and the different kind of experiments that have tackled these components. It turns out from this data that the mixing angles are large, and we have a hint since this summer that maybe theta 1-3 is different from zero, from T2K. We are waiting for better statistics to figure out. There are also phases involved in the representation of this matrix, and they can be probed through double beta decay. So if we look at our knowledge currently of the distribution of the masses, that's a picture we get. We know that every flavor, nu e, nu mu, nu tau, is made up from a different composition of mass eigenstates. We know precisely how they are separated through oscillation experiments. We know some of their organization, but we don't know all of the organization. In particular, we don't know if the mass states are organized like this or like that. We call that the normal hierarchy and this inverted hierarchy. Something else we don't know is how far the lowest mass eigenstate is from zero, if perhaps zero at all. So if that would be very far away from zero, we would say that the mass representation is degenerate. We get some input from different fields. These numbers are not entirely accurate, but cosmology can put some bounds. But all in all, we see that there's still a lot to know. So the picture that emerges from this data is that we want to know the absolute mass scale. That's the next thing we want to measure. We want to measure the mixing angle theta 1-3, if it's different from zero, probe for CP violation effects, and the choice of hierarchy. These are the big challenges in neutrino physics. It turns out that making these experiments is getting non-trivial on a time scale comparable with a physicist's career, not only a thesis. When I left Neuchâtel, as Cliff was mentioning, I was supposed to have written my thesis on the first data of the MUNU experiment, and that was still in construction. When I started SNOW, I expected within a year to be very quickly in commissioning data, and I'm very glad I stayed for another 10 years so I could enjoy the fun of analyzing exciting neutrino oscillation data. So that's always to keep in the background. So I'm speaking here as the experimentalist who has to really make the thing work and hope that if I retire before it's finished. Yes?
I think experimentally one can add also the issue that the neutral currents haven't been measured that well in neutrinos.
Which cycle are you talking about?
For the neutrino, the neutral currents, the coupling to the neutrinos to the nucleus, for example, the neutral current, that has not been measured that well.
Well, at low energy, this was quite well measured with solar neutrinos.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you could add certain operators there that are actually not that well constrained by that, like those measures.
I think you're giving me exactly the handle that I needed. Among the whole jungle of the possibilities, this presentation is going to take a very narrow path uh-huh. on one possible measurement we aim to do, which is the zero new double beta decay. And later on, I will pick exactly on your comment that I ignore the right-handed currents, for example, entirely in the interpretation of the results. But I welcome more questions, and I'm sorry if I cannot provide an answer. So if we make a list of all these questions that are still open from the data, is neutrino its own antiparticle? We don't know the mass scale, the hierarchy, the theta-1-3 mixing angle, and the phases. Now it's of value to look at what the different experimental approaches can teach us in this field. If we look at the beta endpoint and cosmology, double beta decay, they all contribute one way or the other to these different fields, but you see that double beta decay is the approach that actually connects to quite a number of questions, in particular these three here. So we think as a single experimental approach, it has quite a good through output if successful. So let's focus a little more on that. So we have just discussed a rationale why we want to do double beta decay. And so again, we believe that's the only technique to determine if they are their own antiparticles, if the neutrino is a particle with a Majorana mass term. It's the most promising method for measuring the absolute mass scale, and on the fly, it tests also the lepton conservation. So there are two kinds of double beta decay. One is called the allowed or two new mode. That is a conventional second order process. We can calculate from the observed half-life here. We can actually predict the nuclear matrix elements for that transition, and the phase space factor is something that can be calculated. The other one, the one that we're really interested in, is one that is called the zero nu neutrino-less double beta decay. And in this mode, it requires that the neutrino is its own antiparticle, Majorana mass different from zero, which allows this kind of diagram, and then you relate the observed transition rate or the lack of it, a limit, and translate that into a limit on the effective mass of the neutrino that violates the lepton number by 2 units. There's also a phase space factor here and another set of nuclear matrix elements to calculate. So the bottom line here is that first, the results I'm presenting today are about that because they were not seen before in this isotope. And second, that no matter which decay you look at, you need to understand the nuclear matrix elements quite well. So that shows in a little more detail what we mean with the effective Majorana mass. That's a linear combination here. I guess all the experts in the room know that depending what the phases are, there could be cancellation in some instances, and actually maybe this transition happens to be totally unobservable. Still, a point of value for the experimentalists is that the phase space factor depends on the fifth power of the Q value and the need to have the nuclear matrix elements calculated. So normally we represent results now on this kind of diagram where we plot the measured limit. Actually, experimentalists provide a limit here, which is a horizontal line, which is the effective mass we infer from the former formula as a function of the lightest neutrino mass. And these two bands in green and red show the available parameter space taking all the oscillation data available. So we know that nature must have chosen a solution that is within these bands. So we recognize here the normal hierarchy in red, inverted in green, and when you're far away from zero, both are indistinguishable, and we call that degenerate. We see cosmology here providing a limit from the right. We discussed that earlier on Cliff visibly. When that plot was made, the limit was order of 100 milliEV as a limit from cosmology.
As it looks like the cosmologists can never win, because it seems like if you head towards zero, then they can never distinguish these two things.
That's right. So this was my argument, saying that no matter how much you improve on the limit, how much you constrain the total mass, knowing the other mass differences, this is a vertical line shifting to the right.
But it's that's only because of the way it's being plotted, because they're bounding that sum of the masses. And so if the sum of the if they can distinguish between, you know, the inverted and the normal hierarchies are going to differ by a factor of two more or less of the heaviest mass. If they can get in between there, they can exclude the inverted hierarchy. And you miss that on this plot because really that they can take the, in principle they could take the lightest mass right to zero if they get that bound good enough, right? And on a log scale, that looks like that's astronomically far away. But
and the other thing that's not clear to me is how much actually they could get a number. How far do they have to go with the? I don't know how much.
There's a lot of uncertainties and everything. But supposing you gave them the benefit of the doubt, and say they could exactly tell you an upper bound, this plot would make it sound like they could never distinguish these hierarchies, whereas they couldn't distinguish, right? Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So now, if you want to observe double beta decay, either mode, you want to make sure the nucleus you pick is undergoing normal beta decay, first order beta decay. So you want this transition to be forbidden, and typically you look at even nuclei for that. Xenon is displayed here as an example. And once you have this condition met, you look for a number of other criteria. We like to have a relatively large Q value. Remember, this goes with the fifth power for the phase space factor transition rate. Of course, it's also important to have materials that have a useful abundance, where enrichment is not too costly. And you see that this varies quite a bit between a small fraction of a percent here to almost a third of the natural abundance. The observables aren't very many, and that's one point that we'll come to again when I talk about EXO. Yes.
Can you go back one time? So you're using the xenon to beryllium?
Beryllium.
Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Now, there have been other measurements in the world of that process, no?
Yes.
Which element did you use? Did they use? Does they all use xenon 136?
No. I'm not sure what you mean with they.
I'm forgetting the name, but.
Experiments have looked for 2 nu and 0 nu in many isotopes, and I will address that later.
I
have a table that shows the current limits on the 0 nu, and I have a table for the current measurements on the 2 nu in all isotopes that were looked.
So is there a reason to prefer one of those entries over the others?
At the end, yes, it's a person's taste and skill. Some people are better at cryogeny, some people are better at tracking, some people do better TPCs. But this is an introduction to all the requirements. You want this to be relatively high for two reasons. First, to have a high transition rate, and second is to be above your background. The other one is you want to make something that is you can convince a funding agency to find money to enrich so much isotope. But there are other reasons coming up. These listed here have all been probed one way or the other by different experiments. Exactly counting is geological experiments where you take an ore, you assume that ore has been undisturbed for a million years, and you look for the daughter nucleus, and you derive the limit from the ratio. These are considered in the community to be a little more brittle, because you make this assumption that the sample hasn't been disturbed chemically over billions of years, and there's no control to help you frame that. It's very difficult to verify that assumption. But all of them here have been probed. So if I come back to the main challenge of the field, which is that typically we have only one observable, which is the sum energy of the two electrons following the decay. So if you have a 4-lepton final state, you get this distribution because you only see the energy from the electrons, not from the neutrinos. So the 2 nu looks like that, and the 0 nu looks like that. So I discussed now that we want favorable nuclear matrix elements for selecting the compound we want to work with, high natural abundance, high Q value, also to be further away from the background, and the practicality of the detector concept.
Between those two things?
It was very fashionable when I was a grad student, and I don't know why people tend not to do that as much anymore. Although it's in everybody's mind that we should provide a limit for the Majorana as well.
Because it's not unique either, because there's a class of, they're characterized by the power of Q essentially, and
right.
Then there's two or three options between those two extremes.
And there are even spectral distribution,
you mean
there are more particles predicted that pushes, that makes the spectrum even softer.
If you but the measurement is here, right?
The two neutrinos meet in one line and I meet another particle, the Maron.
Yeah,
and then it's a three-body decay rods and a two-body.
And the surprise is that this, the kind of the vanilla Maron, you would have thought it's a Goldstone boson, so there'd be powers of Q with that. But they're not for a, kind of a, an odd reason. But you can make models where you can get different powers of energy suppression in the threshold for the emission of that scale. And I remember at one point people were, I mean, back in the day, people were put them all together. I don't know if those bounds have improved since then. Or, I don't know how difference, how much of a difference it makes to you guys what the energy dependence is of the spectrum when you're pointing.
Well, the answer is, what do you have in here? The answer is essentially, if you happen to have just a potassium line in here, you're not going to get a very good limit on the Majoron. But by experiencing what people do at conferences, people really go after the zero nu. That's where the bread and butter is. That's where you justify your job. Whereas this is more to help the theorists confirm that they understand their calculations for nuclear matrix elements, although the two are not directly linked. That's still a validation of their approach. And then what I see is people say, oh, and by the way, we have derived the limit for the Majoron, and that's the value. I don't see this as being very central in the field now. I'm not sure I can explain why. From the context of the introduction, you can see people are really entirely focused on going for the zero nu. At least what people want to do, if I can go back a couple slides, what people want to do now is to try to eliminate one of the scenarios. Because that is perceived as being a major contribution to the field, to be able to keep up the RP. If on the fly, you see the zero nu decay, then you've learned nothing because it could still be here in the normal range, but you've seen it and you've gained something else. And you have to prove that this is really the kind of decay you think it is, and you go for angular correlation. I just see the Majoron not being discussed that much, probably because it's not directly central to this plot here. But people produce limits anyway. So we haven't, because our data isn't good enough to do it yet. But we plan to do it. But I'm talking about the single Majoron emission. I think there's another one with the emission of two Majoron, which is harder to distinguish from the two new spectrum. I forgot the details. There's one decay mode that involves two Majoron that is a little softer here and closer to the two new. So let me go to, we'll conclude that section here with the tables I was promising. What I want to stress out is what the challenges are when you're building this experiment. Visibly, you want to look for very, very rare decays. So you need, you're looking at very low transition rates. Therefore, you want as many nuclei as possible to look at, which means you need detectors that are huge, very large fiducial mass, tons we're talking about for the next generation. At the same time, you have to reduce and control your backgrounds in new ways that weren't good enough before, that didn't exist before, and the methods before weren't good enough. So if you look at the two formula below, that's a major motivation for trying to make the experiments background free. If you have a background that scales like a linear function of time, you know your limit is going to be restricted by the square root of the number of counts, and you know that is itself an error on your background. So all in all, you get your limit going with a fourth power of time. Whereas if you go with no background, then you know your limit is going to be determined by the square root of the number of counts, which is directly what you're after. So then your limit grows with the square root of time and not the fourth root of time. So pretty much everybody is trying to make experiments background free for that reason. Now, if we look again at the energy spectrum, here we have added actually the realistic resolution at the Q value for a given experiment. So you see again the two nu and the zero nu spectra. What happens in reality is that the limits or the projected rates for the zero nu are so much lower than the allowed two nu transition that you can see the two nu spectrum starts becoming a background here to the zero nu, which is quite amazing if you think the half-lives are of order of 10 to the 20 years. This is a background to what we are after. So the main point to get from that is that the better your energy resolution, the more competitive you will be. So people work very hard on that. Again, you see the same formula here on how you derive your limits if you have background or no background. And you find that the energy resolution enters actually both in different ways. You want to have very, very good energy resolution. So a few words on the different kind of detectors.
Where does energy resolution come from in the no background phase?
Sorry?
In the zero background phase?
The resolution is essentially your analysis window.
No, I understand that, but where does it come in the case of zero background?
Oh, it doesn't show directly here, because then you can calculate from B being your background rate here due to the two mu. And this quantity B, you can calculate directly from the shape of the function.
Oh, you're just saying the zero background is when you don't have that sort of thing. So,
here, yeah. If you have zero background, you have to demonstrate it's still over quite a large energy window. And the larger it is, the harder it is to demonstrate that. The more likely you are to have counts in this window. So if we look at the kind of experiments that can be designed to do double beta decay, we see actually three categories depending if the source is the same material as the detector or not, and if you look for the tracks or not of your two beta events. So most solid and liquid detectors use that paradigm where the detector is the same mass as the source. For example, germanium detectors, the germanium is made from even nuclei. Germanium-76, and it is the same germanium-76 that detects the two electrons that gives you, in general, the best energy resolution and the best containment because it's condensed matter. Once you're interested in tracking, then you find most of the gas detectors. Those that use the source detector paradigm have the best tracking, but in general, they tend to have just a good, maybe comparable energy resolution for xenon. We might be able to do better than the liquid to be demonstrated, but you lose in containment because you have a larger fraction of the events that escape the active volume simply because the tracks are larger in the gas than they are in the condensed phase. And finally, the last category is when you put, for example, your source on a foil, you immerse your foil in a gas that you use to record the tracks. You get very good tracking, but usually this is at the cost of the energy efficiency resolution, and some cost to the containment. So these are just examples taken from real life of an example where you do calorimetry. You see, I'm showing here the spectrum of something that was like 15 years of work for 40 people. That's one spectrum and that's it. That's your data. That's what you bet your career on. Some people tend to look at this field as a high-risk field where you don't know if you're going to find something, or you know it's relevant only once you have found something. And you look here at this region of the spectrum, you expand and you see background lines, and you put an exclusion peak here to put a limit. In the case of a tracking detector, the same holds, although you have the tracks to do the analysis. So for every event, you use the topology of the event to take them out or include them into the data set to finally analyze, and you look for the zero new. But you can see here the energy resolution. That's a real, these are all real case examples from a Coricino and from an MO3. Different experiments, and you can see the energy resolution is not as good, therefore your limits might not be as competitive. It's all a trade-off. So we're coming back to your question, which element do you choose? And that depends on your skills. If you think you can push the technology better, you're going to go in that technology, and you're going to try to be smarter, making the foils thinner, the track measurements better, and so on. So that's why people take different approaches. But also, because we believe that if neutrinoless double beta decay is observed, we should see it in more than nucleus before we believe in it. If this is really there, it should be there for all nuclei in a way that is understood.
So, sorry, what are the lines in those calorimetric experiments? Are
those here?
Yeah.
These are the alphas that are downgraded. For example, the surface alphas suffer a lot of quenching, so they look like they are at a much lower energy than the electrons would record at. That's what they are. And you see exactly what the problem is. So this experiment now has upgraded to a larger version called Cuore, who has found a way to clean the surfaces better and get rid of the alpha on the surface. That's how the field keeps moving. Yes?
So in dark matter, the direct detection experiments, they reject those alphas because the alphas give out less light.
You look at the light distribution, yes. So depending on the crystal you have, you could do that as well. Here, what they measure actually what they measure here actually is the heat generated in a crystal, the temperature difference. And because the alpha lose a lot of energy in a different way than heat, there's recombination taking place and probably emission of light that downgrades them to a lower energy. And a spin-off of this experiment is to do exactly what you propose, is to not only look at the heat, but also look at the light produced, and then do a discrimination similar to dark matter. That experiment is called Lucifer. Don't ask me how people pick up their names. I find EXO made sense. Another comment I want to make.
Use sulfur as their target?
Almost. There's zinc involved. So another comment I wanted to make, I think you all got the message that we need to make experiments that have extremely low backgrounds, counts per ton per year, depending where in the spectrum you look at. This is visibly not the case here. We're talking here about counts per kV per kilogram per day. So this is work done at Heidelberg, where you see a typical germanium detector that is somewhat underground. They have a basement with no shielding. Adding the shielding makes a huge difference. And then going underground here makes yet one more big difference, about two orders of magnitude, simply because underground you have the radioactivity of the rock, but you're shielded from all the radioactivity from the muons. The muons create problems in different ways. First, they penetrate in your detector, so you have to have an active veto, some scintillator that says, okay, something went through now, don't use that event, or maybe don't use anything for the next 5 milliseconds. And the other one, which is a little more nasty, is the spallation events where neutrons just explode nuclei and you have free neutrons flying around that give you counts. That's especially a problem for dark matter. This is a very nasty background for dark matter. Then you need to have active veto around, but you may lose a lot of dead time. So in general, what you do is you add shielding. So the active veto, as I said, reduces lifetime. So for a best performance, you still have to go deep as is necessary. One serious problem, and I'm sure those of you in the room who make very complex calculations will be surprised to hear that it's very difficult to produce a depth requirement calculation. Funding agencies like to hear that. They want to hear us say, well, how deep do you need to go to find the zero new double beta decay? It requires an extremely detailed Monte Carlo to produce an answer to that. So what people do is to make...
Can you say that again? You need detailed calculation for doing what?
Simulation. To predict how deep you need to go in order to set your physics targets, to say we are going to meet our physics targets. So the difficulty is everywhere. First, the flux changes a little bit depending where you are on the Earth. Then the flux underground will depend on the kind of rock you're in, quite a bit. Then the geometry of the rock around you and the composition of the rock will change the rate of production of free neutrons. And the exact geometry of your lab and how your detector is built will change how these neutrons propagate and interfere inside your detector. It's very complex. So in general, people have tried to provide guidelines, but they are always taken with a grain of salt. Sorry for the pun. Whip is a salt mine.
So there's something I'm a little confused about that. So I mean, typically, they place the whole thing in a big lead shield. Why should it matter if I produce neutron anyway?
Well, lead is very bad to start with because it makes low energy gamma rays. So you want to put something cleaner inside, which is copper. But then copper is very bad because a few neutrons that go through it will activate a little bit. So you need to have some reasonable compromise. Designing a shielding is complex to start with. And then outside of that, the best is if you can frame your whole volume of, say, lead plus copper to whatever else you have with a light Z inside close to your detector, if you can wrap all that into an envelope of active veto, like scintillation counters, that can tell you, okay, there's a muon that went through. The only muon of the day just went by. Then you know you don't look at data for 10, 20, 30 milliseconds. But you still have the question, what about the muon that hit the rock and just exploded one nucleus and the neutrons find their way?
So this is what I don't understand. Why should that be a background? I mean, isn't the lead shell supposed to protect from those?
Well, the lead is, I wouldn't say transparent to neutrons, but because of the very high mass, the neutrons are more likely to bounce off the very heavy nuclei and are going to find their way through. So lead is not a good shielding for neutrons at all. Lead is a good shielding for gamma rays. And then the copper is better because it doesn't have the lead-210 that produces gamma rays itself. And it's pretty difficult to find lead that doesn't have lead-210 because all ores have accumulation of all kinds of lead. And so we use copper for the inner part of the shielding. And we look for the cleanest copper we can find on the planet. But copper doesn't do much for your neutrons either. You need something with a very light Z, like protons. You need water, paraffin, organic molecules that have free protons in the stoichiometry.
Are you serious? So with all these things, your
I think I am serious. Yes.
you have a lot of
time. I'm trying very hard to be serious. sincerely trying to be serious.
It's still transparent to neutrons?
Well, the word transparent is a relative statement. It's not good enough to filter all the neutrons.
There's still no energy.
The dark matter experiments we're talking about at Snow Lab now, they're worried about one neutron per ton per year. This is very, very difficult to filter out. Actually, you need to make sure your shielding doesn't produce as many, and then you put something around to absorb those coming from the rock. The rock is a very generous source of neutrons. So yes, the answer is many neutrons will find their way through this material.
And so did I also hear you correctly? Then the actual geometry of the cavern you're in matters
at
the order one level?
That's exactly what I meant here. Detailed Monte Carlo includes the geometry of the
cavern. So you must know like now some roughly optimal shape for your cavern?
Usually it goes the other way, where you don't have the option to build a cavern of your dreams, but you are given a hole in the ground, and they tell you that's it.
Wow.
And then you go and measure it and try to find the information on the geology of it. This is quite important. So the approach most people take, I was referring here, I was making a statement on how difficult it is to predict your background accurately. So what people do is to make calculations that are so conservative that you can say, well, that's good enough. And typically now, to give an example, WIP is at this depth now because it's good enough for what we're doing. It will be good enough for the zero nu we aim at, and it was, you'd see, good enough for the two nu. However, for the next scale, we still claim we are the experiment with the most competitive goal on the market, and we need to go at something this depth.
Is there a space for you there?
We have to bid for it. It's a competitive process. I didn't plan to talk about that. I'm not sure how much more time I have.
Go ahead.
Sorry?
Go ahead.
The short answer is that used to be called Doozel. Now it's Zoozel, the American effort to make a similar lab. That seems not to be flying in the near future. DOE pulled out. They don't want to fund it. NSF isn't much yet. NSF has released some money to make a study, the Marks report, maybe you heard of that, and the outcome was that if they look at the economics, everything they were planning to do at Suzel seems to be a lot cheaper at Snow Lab. So if the Americans now decide to approach the Canadians and say, could we build another cavity next to you, please, and we'll put an American flag on it, are they going to bid for the same space? We don't know. But I can comment that Snow Lab is pretty much oversubscribed now with the experiments that already plan to go there. So Snow Lab, in that sense, is a real success because there are more experiments who plan to come than there might be space. So we don't know. We are going to bid for the space. The cryopit was built with EXO in mind. EXO was always very clear that we would go wherever the physics is done the best and the economics is the more. Everything is contemplated is the best option. But we are going to build seriously. I'll show a couple of designs soon.
You started 10 minutes late. So.
Pardon me?
You started 10 minutes late. So you have fun.
Does that work? I started late, so I have more time.
Your talk can go at 10 minutes past 1.
Does that work for
someone? One
if I start at last year, I have as much time as I want.
I think you usually run out of the class 5 minutes before.
Okay, so this is the slide I promised before. That's where we stand now in terms of the search for zero nu. So there's that one claim. I had one more slide coming up of the Heidelberg-Moskau collaboration. These are the initial of the authors who looked in germanium. That's just a calorimeter. And they claim they've seen the decay. They claim they've seen it, and they claim they have a range for the mass, and they claim everything is done, and everybody else is wasting their time. They should all go home and think about doing real physics. And there's the rest of us, although EXO is not listed here yet. I just put the most relevant recent limit. We just talked about the tellurium case for Ricino. We just talked about NEMO. The example I showed was this isotope here. And what I wanted to show is a number of things. First, we look at different isotopes. We look at different detector types. We look at exposures that are typically in the sub to a few 10 kilogram years. You measure the mass of your isotope to have and the amount of light time in years, and you take the product. And you see the limits. Well, these people claim they have rates, a half-life, at 10 to the 25, but here it's at 10 to the 24, 10 to 25. These are quite high time scales. So that's where we are, although that is just a half-life as you observe it. There are nuclear elements, the space factors that come in. So really what we are after is this quantity, and you can see none of them is really usefully excluding that range. That's why everybody wants to go up at least one order of magnitude and beyond. These are planned to start. These are limits that were just produced at the Tau P conference.
Is it just luck that NEMO gets exactly the same bound as the other guys found in the three guest places?
Thank you, Cliff. I should have edited that set. No, that's a mistake of mine. Thank you. That's impossible. That's absolutely impossible. this one is that's selenium. This one is a little lower. So the tangent. I'm sorry. Thank you for picking this up. You know these numbers quite well. Let me make one more important comment here about that claim here. That claim is disputed by the rest of the collaboration who has run the same experiment. So you have a group of people who produce data. One part of the collaboration says we've seen an effect. The other part of the collaboration says, no, you cannot say that from our data. That's, in my opinion, not a good start for making a claim. Although the proponent here, Klapdor, is a very smart person. That is still a major weaknesses. And the rest of the community considers actually that claim as contentious. I have one more slide to explain that. That was his original claim. You see in 2004, using 71 kilogram years, here he claimed he has seen a beautiful peak exactly there where the Q value is. It's 2039 actually. And from that, he derives this half-life and this range for the mass. Now, if you look a little closer at the data, there are a number of crystals, five crystals involved. And they all don't all produce the same contribution to this spectrum. The level of background that is fit as almost a flat line here, a very shallow exponential, that level depends on the inclusion of all the peaks. So the analysis, we believe, is suffering many weaknesses. In 2006, an update, which I have shown in a former slide, used fewer crystals, so a smaller mass of 30 kilogram years, and now claims a Six Sigma discovery. On the argument that some of the crystals used in here were not allowing really an analysis with the same potential, that you couldn't reject background as well with some crystals. So it's all, maybe he's seen something, maybe he's right, but that has too many flags raised that the community wants to consider that potential. So as a response to that, new generations have decided to run to design new type of experiments. You can see here a factor of 10 roughly larger, where if he's right, they should see a signal of 135 counts, with typically 1 or 8 count, depending on your situation. What you aim for is that what has been achieved at the time was here. So that's the idea of what we're trying to do now in the field. We're trying to design experiments that really put that in the past, and if there's a signal of that strength, then it should stand out clearly. So in general, experiments aim around 100 milli-EV for the effective neutrino mass. And that's a selection that answers your question finally with all the choices of isotopes, the different experiments, the kind of mass chosen. That's what people are building now. That's happening for real. All of these names here have dozens of people aligned and substantial grants running for now at least 10 years to make this happen. Here is Lucifer I was talking about before. That's selenium here, not sulfur. And you see that the EXO 200, the experiments we have now, is about 140 kilograms. We're aiming for 100 milli-EV. We have started data taking, and other experiments are in the near future starting. All of these experiments plan to go for a couple of years before they reach their limits.
So the MEE is the expected limit you put on the...
Yes, that's the projected limit by the experiment. These are also numbers that are very difficult to reproduce on your own if you're not on the experiment. I put here at the end some experiment that stands a little bit out of this crowd, except next to 100, experiments that go quite below the 100. There's one here, there's one here. These are the next generation experiments, and I'll finish my talk by talking about full EXO. That's really what we plan to do, and we aim to go at the very low mass, 5 to 20 milli-EV. What you want to retain from this side here is that we want to see a signal in more than one isotope before we are convinced that something in nature happens that can be called neutrinoless double beta decay. And there's also visibly a need to quad this experiment. So I was commenting to Cliff earlier this morning that has been on sites for 5 years now. People realize that there's no way the world can afford 10 tons of xenon here. These people want to also go for tons. Gerda wants to go for tons of germanium. I have enlisted them. Majorana wants to go for tons of germanium. There's no way the community can afford that. As a consequence of speaking publicly on the need to coalesce, we have seen more proposals emerge that have a very national kind of flavor to them. One example is NEXT that supports interest in Spain. This supports interests in Italy, and so on. So the field is still vibrant. I think that's a proof of successful funding. But I think we should follow this intention we had initially, and some of us are very serious, to group all the resources together to build a few experiments that make sense and not bring them all to the ton scale. OK, a few comments on nuclear matrix elements. I will go through that very briefly. Actually, this is borrowed from a very nice presentation from Peter Fogel at Caltech, who is a member of the EXO collaboration, who gave that talk at the collaboration meeting on EXO. And I extracted a few slides just to explain some of the features we see with the nuclear matrix element calculation. First, if you really look at the nuclear matrix elements for the two new transition, they are very scattered. Actually, xenon here was a limit. Now we've measured it to be about 0.2, which is the real value is about. So the first thing we observe is that the two new nuclear matrix elements are very scattered. The zero new nuclear matrix elements are dimensionless, and physically we have not measured them yet, except for that one claim. The methods to evaluate them are quite different. But it is expected from all methods that the zero new nuclear matrix elements would vary a lot more slowly than in the two new case. And people understand that on a fundamental basis, these sets are different, but they can that difference relates on a different scale of the momentum transfer, whereas for the two new, it's order of the Q value. It's the Fermi momentum for the zero. That's a selection of some predictions from a wide range of different models of what the zero new nuclear matrix elements would be. You can see there's less scattering. There's less variation from one nucleus to the other as well. And the questions are, can we understand these differences? Is there a formal relationship between the two? And if this relationship exists, can it be used to test the zero new calculation? So I'll skip some of the details here, but I wanted to show this, that the difference relies essentially on the distance between the two neutrons that undergo decay in the nucleus. This is expressed by two functions, C, 0 nu and 2 nu, that are function of that distance R, which have to be integrated in order to produce the nuclear matrix element. So if you look at how these functions behave with a large Fermi momentum, the large value of the Fermi momentum, you get a function that is mostly non-zero at low radii, whereas for the two new case, this function is also a lot more uncertain and fluctuating a lot more. So in the integral, this is what explains this variation between elements and between models. So the question is that both transitions operators, I should say, connect to always the same ground states. And the problem is to evaluate these ground states to start with, and there will always be uncertainty related to that. That cannot be done exactly. And finally, the explanation of the two new decay rate is necessary. If a model works, it should work also for the two new, but that might not be sufficient. In one of the models called quasi-random phase approximation, there's an additional bonus. The model has a free parameter called GPP. It has another free parameter, which is the number of levels you want to use in your calculation. And it turns out that if you get a measurement from an experiment of the two new nuclear matrix element, you set here the value of GPP, and you find that the predictions, no matter what the orbits are, will be the same for the two zero nu and two nu cases. So there's a very indirect benefit in knowing the two nu. And I think the bottom line is everything we have discussed before. Nobody has been able so far, not only Peter Fogel and his group, to deduce the zero nu from the simple knowledge of the two nu matrix element. On the other hand, if knowing the two nu helps to set some adjustable parameters, this is a guess probably as good, if not better, as another guess. And in one of the methods, it simplifies even the parameter space for the predictions. And he makes a point here that other methods that make only calculations for the zero nu should be tested and should be making predictions for the two nu as well to see if they reproduce experimental data. Yes?
Yeah, the question about this. So suppose you observe the zero nu decay in two different nuclei. And now you can measure the ratio of m zero nu to m two nu in two different nuclei. Is there a reliable theoretical prediction on that ratio for the different?
It is some sort of implied in these models that predict both the zero nu and the two nu matrix elements.
Mm-hmm.
By predicting both, they predict already the ratio. You take the ratio of the two predictions.
Right, but those rely on a certain model. I mean,
well, this
is
true.
I think the answer is no, because basically it's like the. Zero nu is like a current correlation where you're just measuring the virtual neutrino you don't see. So you just, whereas the two nu you're measuring a second order thing where you're just taking matrix elements of something squared. And there's a couple nuclear levels that appear, and that makes it very nucleus specific. But there's no general relationship between the thing where you're summing over many levels and the thing that's seeing just a couple levels. So you need a model, but so did these guys with the model predict your matrix element for two nu before you?
Yes. Three. Well, I have a slide further down that shows that. What is that? QRPA and I think ISM and IBM. I'm not sure. We will see. The three models were within close range of our measured value for the two nu.
And is that the first time? I remember in the first iteration of these experiments, all the predictions for the two nu were way off, and then they kind of tuned their calculations based on what was measured. And then I lost track of the field, so I don't know if they...
Yeah, the story is quite complex. One event, I think, stellar evolution astrophysicists would call that a glitch, was when two different kind of major models ended up finding a factor of two error in their calculations, and at some point, this was 4 years ago, they revised their calculation and adjusted to that. And since then, the fluctuations between models has been a lot less. I think over the years, all these models have improved, and we have seen that the scattering, the scattering shown here is much less than what was seen years ago for the zero nu range.
But how many of those were predictions that were then measured and tested?
Well, that's a zero nu. There's no measurement for the zero.
Well, that's zero. You know, that's more robust. But of the two new ones, to what extent are they successful at predicting the experiments before the experiments are done?
Historically, the problem has been for the heavier nuclei. People claim that lighter nuclei are heavier to calculate with. And I think the agreement was relatively good with the lighter nuclei, and people didn't trust the calculations for the larger ones. Except there were measurements, I think tellurium 128 was obtained through these geochemical experiments, and there was a good agreement there with the expected two nu rate. However, we discussed before that question that with the geochemical experiments, you don't know really if the history matches, so you have another uncertainty on top of that. So this was vaguer. I don't have a recollection that really some predictions were completely off, and people used the fact of being off to refine the model and improve that, and that is a consequence for the heavier masses. I do remember that until a few years ago, people said you can't calculate nubium 150, it's a deform nucleus, let's forget about it. And people say no, not anymore, we found ways to do that. I'm not enough of an expert to really comment further.
When you say a model, what exactly goes into the model? Is it
how you treat the nucleus, what kind of interaction you postulate, do you work with an effective potential? Some models assume some form of an interaction between nucleons, depending which orbits they're on. Other models, for example, look only on the an average density of levels. They call that statistical nuclear spectroscopy. That's how far my knowledge goes in nuclear physics. But they really postulate different assumptions on how to describe the behavior of single nucleons in the nuclear environment, and they build the complexity of the atoms on these postulates. What are we supposed to talk about, right? Okay, EXO. What is it? EXO is a multi-phase program. That's not just EXO 200. That's my most important slide, I would say. It's a multi-phase program to search for neutrino-less double beta decay and hopefully discover it. The ultimate goal is a ton-scale experiment with 10 mEV sensitivity. And we will see that for that, we claim we can beat the competition by using a method nobody else is using yet, which is to go and look for the daughter ion. I have a few slides on that. EXO 200 that I'm reporting on today is a prototype experiment. It's still considered a physics experiment. It's an IPP-approved experiment as EXO 200, not as full EXO, for example, to gain experience with liquid xenon. And the physics goals were the measurement of the 2 nu rate. We know it's a background. We need to know that rate, and that's the purpose of this talk. And an improved limit on the effective mass of the neutrino. We think that up to two years lifetime is sufficient for that. We hope to have a result by the spring next year because we think our data will be good enough to have a competitive result. In parallel, we are also gaining experience to build a 10 kilogram gas detector because it's not obvious that liquid is the best technology for a full detector. So why we like xenon so much, that was the question you asked also earlier on. There's no need to grow crystals. That's quite an involvement. It can be repurified as you run the experiment, just circulate the gas. There's no long-lived isotopes. It can be easily transferred from one detector to another. Imagine now we would find a zero nu. We're doing R&D work on a gas detector. Maybe that's just a prototype that's not good enough. It's not low background, but we will be already one step ahead in order to transfer this xenon to a gas detector and try to look for the angular correlation between the tracks, which is one way to identify that you really have the transition you claim in your detector. That's related. Noble gas is easier to purify. The enrichment is just easier and safer simply because you have a delta M over M. That's a lot. Does that work? We have 4.7 atomic mass unit, which is in your favor. And now, you've seen this plot before. That's normally the only observable people have. We're adding one more. We're adding the tagging of the daughter nucleus. With that, we claim we can substantially reduce our backgrounds by going at the location where we think energetically there was a double beta decay event and go and look there if we can find a barium ion. If we don't find it, that was background. How we identify the ion is with a laser spectroscopy. We pump the state the ground state into a P state with a blue laser, which decays either way, but it can decay in that metastable state here. You turn off your blue laser light, turn on a red laser, and then you should see the blue light come back if you had any barium-136 present in your system. That's a very well studied system. There's no contamination for anything else in these two wavelengths. It turns out that when you do that, when you implement this technology, you can get up to 10 to the 7 photons per second. So it's a very easily observed signal. I hope I can convince you we've done that. Another improvement that we have implemented in liquid xenon is if you look at the charge only, you don't get a very good energy resolution. If you look at the charge only, you don't get good energy resolution. But if you combine them, you can rotate your energy scale and go along this axis here, and you can vastly improve your energy resolution. You see here how the resolution improves as a function of the electric field. And you can see that if you have ionization only, we reproduce former data. But if we combine with the scintillation, we are a lot better. And that allows us to predict that at the Q value, we believe that we'll be at 1.4%, which makes EXO a very competitive experiment for neutrino-less double beta decay. I will skip through the details of that, although depending which audience this is, that I would spend most of the time on this slide. This is to explain the whole program. We have a liquid xenon. So essentially, in red, what we have done. In blue, what's in progress. And in black, what we still have to do. And that's our roadmap to the discovery of the zero nu decay. So we work with a liquid that's called EXO 200. In parallel, we develop barium tagging in the liquid. We work in the gas. That's called the xenon electroluminescent prototype. We also develop barium tagging in the gas. And in parallel, we have learned, that's done, how to enrich large amount of xenon. And we've built a detector with it and produced data. On the same time, we are planning and designing the ton scale detector. Right, the 136 mass in xenon is about 8% natural abundance, and we boosted it to 80%. That's part of the design of the full detector, that we may not need such a high enrichment anyways, depending if you go gas or liquid. There are some tricks you can play and save a few years and probably $1 million on the level and quantity of xenon you need to enrich. So the barium tagging occurs this way. We have a trap working at very low pressure. Not absolute vacuum, though, because you need to cool the ions. You inject the barium. That's just a test showing we have an oven injecting barium. But we have been successful at injecting baryon ions one at a time. There's a slowly shaped here field DC along the axis of the trap. And every segment here is held at a time-varied hyperbolic field. Assures that we maintain a time-varying hyperbolic field in the space in between, which confines all the orbits within the center of the trap, and then very quickly the ions orbit here, slow down and cool down here, and here we do the laser spectroscopy I was talking about before. That's what the equipment looks like, and that's what the data looks like. So that's a picture taken with the CCD. You see the two metallic rods on the side. That's the analysis volume here, and when you take 5 second illumination to get this data. And this is repeated in many different ways. And we have convinced ourselves that every step corresponds to a fixed number of ions in a trap until that doesn't change. And we believe this is our background level. So this is working. We can tag single ions. We know this works. This is a histogram of the same data that shows how well separated they are. Now let me focus on XO200. No barium tagging. This wasn't necessary here. And we have 200 kilogram of enriched xenon. What was new with this experiment is that we developed an extensive material screening program. We looked at every possible material, lead, copper, whatever went in the detector. Not only did we set the specs how clean they can be for radioactivity, but also we did develop a very detailed Monte Carlo predicting what our background will be. Some of the measurements are limited, so this is not as useful as a tool as we expected. However, this paper here has been intensely scrutinized by the community and news, and we are planning to write a second one. So we do neutron activation, ICP-MS, radon emanation. That's one of my contributions to EXO, gamma counting, and alpha counting. The detector looks like that. Two half TPCs. Cathode is at the center. Readout planes are in the back. We have some Teflon reflectors. To define the field, we have these copper rings here held in place by acrylics, and the cleanest acrylic we could find on the planet was still the snow acrylic. So we recycled snow acrylic inside the EXO, and that's what these little rods are. Some other components, the wires were etched from a foil, the clean room at Stanford where everything was built. It's ultra clean in terms of dust, so we want to minimize the amount of radioactivity. Here comes the question about shielding. This is not polyethylene. We don't have a neutron shield. We have here the detector I just showed immersed in freon, the coolant, two layers of copper from the cryostat, like a thermos bottle. So we have 2 inches of copper, 25 centimeters of lead. And all that is surrounded by muon Vito scintillators. We are located in one of the dirtiest places in the United States, the waste isolation pilot plant. I think it works both ways. They could convince us that they were clean. That comes with a little bit of money that helps your operations. It's always good to find a lab that supports science with real dollars. And they were more than happy to advertise in the public relations that the place must be safe and clean because these crazy scientists have risked their career to come on the ground to our site. We have guaranteed that we are absolutely not at risk at this place, the way the place is designed. So it's about 800 meters on the ground. In a salt mine, the salt is interesting because it's relatively clean. Results. So this
waste?
Was.
Is it nuclear waste? Or what's the...
Yeah. That's hot waste from the development of weapons. So that was the situation before these results. In xenon 136, we were asking. So here are the predictions. There were 8.4 to the 20, 2.1 to the 21, that's exactly what we measured. That's not a typo, that's really what they predicted. 2.1 to the 22. So you see factor of 10 too high, factor of 3 too low, exactly right on. The ballpark was there. But the problem was at the time that with respect to these predictions, there was some tension. This was my PhD work, actually. I happened to be doing xenon by chance again. We had a limit with a gas detector here that was way below. And then came these two papers here that set a limit that is incompatible with ours. So I have a few words on that. The point at the time was that this paper were also contradicting some of these predictions here, not really this one, but there was some tension. And we said that EXO200 is going to resolve that. We need to measure the two new rates anyways to know our background for the full detector. And on the fly, the bonus is we are going to answer this question. So the data was actually acquired in very little time. We had a run done started in May for 31 days. And 31 days of data here. We don't have the lowest background we can get. The radon shield is not yet in service. We need a trap in the system, which is also not yet in service and doesn't prevent us from doing these measurements. And we haven't finished installation of the front lead because we still need to access the electronics for improvement. Nonetheless, the data is beautiful. You were asking before about the separation between alpha and gamma. That's exactly what we can do with EXO as well. The alpha particle produces a lot of light and are very hard to see here in ionization. Whereas the beta, it's the opposite. They produce a very strong ionization signal and much less light. And that allows us to do alpha spectroscopy and use a coincidence, actually, for that and do measure our background. So we know how much background we have in radon. We had an intense, this was also the responsibility of Laurentian. We found the smallest sources on the market, 0.7 millimeters, designed an enclosure. And these sources are deployed at the end of a cable, 8 meters long at minus 100 C, 166 Kelvin. So this was a major engineering feat to get something to work at this temperature with all the friction involved. And this is our data. The purity means how good we can drift the electrons. So we measure the purity in electron lifetime at 250 microseconds. That's good enough. The typical drift time is 100 microseconds. So we correct for that. And we see that the purity is strongly correlated with the flow rate. And you also see we have kept taking data. That's the plot that I like the most of all the plots we have to report on now. You'll show where in a minute. This shows that if you have a background, a gamma ray coming in, it's going to do Compton very likely before it fully converts at one location. It can do that more than once. Our readout has a finite granularity, 9 millimeters. So some events will look like they're single site. Other events will look like they're multiple sites. We expect our double beta decay events to be single site because the two beta are produced on the same spot and they don't travel more than 3 millimeters. And the cell size is 9 millimeters. Of course, take into account the fact that they could overlap with regions. So you take a calibration source that irradiates the detector with gamma rays, and you do two things. First, you take the data. These are the points here. And the second is you do a Monte Carlo, which is shown in a shaded histogram. There is absolutely no fit in this figure. The shaded histogram is our prediction of what the spectra would look like when we put the source at this location. And the agreement, I hope you are convinced, is quite good. There's some disagreement here. Visibly, some events are leaking for high energy to a low energy. There's some downgrading we have to understand. But we do that everywhere. And the worst place on the sum of the events, the disagreement is 8%. And we think this really convinces us we understand the detector well. The next plot I like very much is coming. It just shows the energy calibrations. The two different sites, because of an artifact of the electronics, show up at different places. We understand that well. This category, multi-site, should be there. That's a systematic band. Single site here. We use also double escape from pair production here and with the prediction, and there's good agreement as well. And this is our energy resolution as a function of energy. We see we're far from the 1.5%, but we don't use the light yet. And we have barely started optimizing the hardware. So this is really looking good for the prospect for EXO200. And that's the plot. That's it. That's here where I hope I can convince you that we have a huge statistics on what we believe are the two new double beta decay events on top of the background. That's a huge change from former experiments. We have really a very nice statistics in the inner two modes, and that produces this limit here. I won't enter the details, except we fit both multi-site and single-site in a single likelihood function where we understand our major backgrounds. Not all of them are shown here, but they all return values very, very small. You can see that from the different shapes, it's quite easily from the two fits to take them apart from each other. To convince ourselves this was real, we also looked at how far away we go from the walls of the detector towards the inside. The two new rates doesn't change really much, whereas the potassium decreases as you would expect from attenuation in a liquid xenon. And if you plot the graph as a function of time, there's no real evidence that there is a time variation in this data as expected.
The potassium 40 is contributing to your background because of the zero background?
No, not really. Well, it's a background to the two new because the two new goes down to zero essentially. So it's that peak here. So it needs to be fitted out.
So that peak in red is the
potassium? That's the potassium 40, that's right. It's
but is that from the potassium to argon 40?
That's right.
So the 1200 kV gamma.
No, it's 1460. Oh, 1460. 1460, that's the one. And you can see also the 2.6 MeV gamma ray from the thorium chain, the thallium. These are the typical background. Again,
how long do you have the data for this?
31 days for that.
Would you have data for that potassium for a year?
You mean former data?
Any sort of data that goes for 1 year, that potassium?
We just started data taking in May, and we're still improving the detector. So that data won't be comparable to the next data we show, because we'll improve on the energy resolution, we'll improve on our backgrounds, and this is expected to go down. Although there's good grounds to think this is coming actually from the vessel itself, the copper vessel we made the TPC of. Because the shape of this function depends on where your background source is. But I remind you that we're interested at 2.4 and maybe here the Q value for the zero. So potassium won't be an issue. The rate isn't high enough to have accidental coincidence.
So how far away are you from the nuclear waste? I mean, it doesn't seem to be a dominant part of your background.
In which units?
I don't know.
In plant length.
Meters.
In terms of meters, that's you can say it's about 4,000 feet.
Okay.
This is rock and salt.
So I guess that's
so
pretty good shielding.
So we're shielded by that.
Okay.
In terms of air connection, we are as soon as the air goes underground to the air intake shaft, it goes two different ways, either to this area or to this one, and they only merge to get out. And if there's any indication of one airflow going into the other, everything shut down the flaps and they investigate.
Okay.
I think we're well protected.
Yeah.
And there's the usual provisions for accessing the clean room. Cleanliness, I mean. Okay, I'm almost finished. So that puts all the measurements you were asking for this data, what has been seen before, and I'm sorry if I don't know how to compare what the predictions were before these elements were actually measured. That's from the measurement. I don't have the prediction before that. But that shows that among all, well, this one is a little low here, but the one in xenon is really the lowest of the matrix elements. And you can see that the half-life here is that's obtained through this geochemical experiment as referring to before. So if you exclude that because of the uncertainties, I think we have measured the slowest process ever observed in nature, 10 to the 21 years. That is very slow. The point we were discussing before with a few of you that is important to us is that we think we have resolved this discrepancy. This is in pretty good agreement with predictions from the calculations before, and that excludes the two other measurements that were in tension with these predictions. These people have not commented yet on our results. A few words to finish. Why do we want to do gas? Well, if you compare the pros and the cons for a liquid versus a gas detector, visibly the tracking is excellent. With the Gotthard TPC, we have demonstrated that we can reject 95% of our background. It's a factor of 20 background reduction. That's enormous, just from seeing the tracks of the detector. So that's really what we want to do. And you can do the angular correlation between the two electrons. If you give up this information, that's all you have. That's the calorimetry. So that's why we believe in Canada, we We are a group of people with the expertise and the will to pull this off. This is a collaboration-wide effort. We're building a detector with 10 kilograms, to operate at 10 bar. We'll run for 1 year at Carlton, then move underground at Snow Lab. Baryon tagging is also being explored in the gas. This is done also by all at Snow Lab and Stanford, and Bern is looking for a dedicated scintillation, micro-mega-oriented readout. David Sinclair came up with this brilliant idea to extract the iron from a 10 bar atmosphere and bring it all the way through to almost back home in a linear trap, which we know that works, because people have been doing that at Triumph. Actually, he met somebody, I think he was on his thesis committee, who was doing that on a different experiment. He was taking a gas from a 10 bar and going into a linear trap at a 10 to the minus 5 millibar, I think, and trying to get the nickel from a reaction, nickel ions, to that trap to study it. And he said, the problem we have is that we have a lot of barium. Barium lives so long in the process that it survives all the selection steps. So we are looking into using the barium ion from the gas detector. That would be the option. So the,
are you doing this in a ton of, this is in a ton?
So the plan is to get it to run first on that scale.
But it gets up basically because it drifts up because of electrode.
Right, you drift it, and here actually you replace the cathode with what is called an RF carpet. So the cathode is replaced by a carpet made from very small rings that are conductive but can be kept at different potentials. And when you play with that, you apply an RF on top of the DC field that you want to keep across the TPC. That's a simulation from a trajectory here. You can exactly move your ion where you want it, and here this tiny nozzle, smaller than a millimeter, where all you guys gushes out. And then you have turbo pumps here that feed it back in, and you do that a couple of times until you are into near vacuum. Initially, I was very skeptical of the technology, but because they're doing that routinely at Triumph, we want to explore it. And the idea is exactly that. So that's the pressure vessel that's going to be used to test the technology of the gas that's now in Carlton. And that's you see the massive turbo pump here, and we have underneath actually cryo pumps that can remove huge amount of gas. I forgot the units, 12 liters per minute per square centimeter or something like that, and can feed back to the system.
But the idea is that you do that only when you know that there's going to something happen?
Right. And then you map. Actually, the problem would be how you map a unit volume into your detector, how you go from the volume you hear dB in your detector, and how you map this into a signal into your trap at the end where you do the laser spectroscopy. How we first understand the efficiencies for the process, but also how we map as a function of time, and which fields have to be configured to do that, the amount of that volume here, how big is it into your identification cell. What we have already calculated is that the main background is you keep having here the 2 nu rate happen everywhere, so you have a lot of baryon in your detector to start with from the 2 nu transition. But we have calculated that if you keep this order of half or a third of a cubic centimeter, no matter what your baryon technique is, your rate of accidentals is going to be 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 7, depending on the condition. So we believe the rate of picking a wrong baryon drifting along because it was produced from your 2 nu transition is very, very small.
Sorry, so this RF technique is to actually pipe baryon from a particular little region in the detector into the trap.
That's
not
right.
Elsewhere.
Right.
Wow.
So you rely really on the electrostatics to drift
uh-huh.
the ion and then get rid of all the xenon. So the xenon is pumped out and fed back to the detector. And then you identify here, which I have shown works very nicely. Single ion at relatively high pressure works nicely. And so we know we can do that. And we're building a prototype here to study the feasibility. Okay. So you can see this is relatively small. That's not a larger investment yet. This will ultimately be connected to that to do exactly this. That's not that. And that's still a prototype for the gas option. Okay, and I'm reaching the end. I just wanted to give credit to the people in Bern who look for mechanisms to insert a tip, change electric fields to collect the ion and then get out of the tip. That's one way we have been exploring for a while. Full exo, let me go very quickly over that. We have now essentially received money from NSF to make a design the concept for Doosan. That's what it looks like here. So we had a team of engineers and a four-year grant for the S4 proposal. And this was also upgraded in order to see how well, that's a different effort by the same collaboration though, to locate a liquid xenon detector inside SnowLab in a cryo pit. So we have this design being worked on, and that's a proposal now at the design, at the sketch level of design, not yet at the concept level, where that what a detector with a gas xenon, I think this is 5 ton of gas, would look like at 10 bar in the cryo pit at SnowLab. So we can tell you how well now we think we can do with full EXO, because we have data with EXO 200. So that's where we're planning to go. That's this claim at about 300 mEV from Clapdo. We want to go factor of three lower than that. So that, I think that's what we'll do with EXO 200. Then with full EXO, depending on the scenario, conservative or very aggressive, we will at least exclude the inverted range, if not probe a fair amount of the area of the normal range here.
How long are you running for to get that limit that you're claiming?
10 years, it's here.
Okay, so EXO 200 is going to run for 10 years?
EXO is, we plan we need 2 years of lifetime for EXO 200.
Okay, so within 2 years you will confirm or refute.
You know, 2 years lifetime is not the real time. The real time is usually a little more.
Right. Okay.
So we think within 3 to 4 years we should have a very competitive limit, and we probably want to move on to build the real full EXO now we know what to do.
Right.
And the runtime for full EXO will be depending on the type of scenario we choose and the available funding. We go either for 5 years running time or 10 years, and we go between 2 and 10 tons. These numbers now are known quite well. Our overall efficiencies. And the resolution also is well understood. See, we're not yet background free in the same sense as before, because we know we'll have a little bit of tuning background. But still, we believe our limits are very competitive. So I'm showing here a slide to conclude from the competition, Camlan Z. That's a detector that was built to look for neutrino oscillations with a scintillating oil. And they saw that if they procured xenon rapidly, they could get 400 kilograms. We have 200, a little higher enrichment. And they dissolve it in a xenon, they can beat us. So that's what they're trying to do here. But you see that in the long run, their plan, I think, has just been adjusted to follow how they view us. So though if I were to do this graph, the curves would look a little bit at different places. And that's the point I want to make about this graph. People do these graphs a lot to try and project where the competition is going to beat you and how to beat them and so on.
Not a very zen thing, though, is it?
Sorry?
Not a very zen thing, is it?
It's just a total mess. It's just a total mess. However, I should have put more to support my claim. I think that in all these graphs that you can see, EXO looks in general quite good. We think we have a robust program in place, we have an aggressive schedule, and we might have something important to say in a few 10 years down the road. Conclusions, we have data. That's good to state when you've been working on an experiment for years and years. Our measurement of the 2U rate is remarkably clean, very little background. Our data agrees with the calculations for the nuclear matrix elements. Our data shows, sorry, that the load limits are wrong. Wait to hear from these guys, no news yet. And the sensitivity projections show that we are in the 5 to 20 mEV range. Ah, yes, one more thing, sorry. Could you please tell me whoever said that? I need to probe as many brains as possible. I thought that PI might have more resonance than other places.
Here it convinces everybody.
Sorry?
Here it convinces everybody.
Okay, sorry. I don't know, try. And I want to thank you for all your contribution to the perception of space and time, for taking this time to wait in that space today. Thank you.
So what's that picture of?
You've been there. It's the Expo 02 in near Neuchâtel. This is how a small country, just 6 million people worth, interprets itself as its position in space and time. So inside this, they put that monolith, but this is a box made of rusty steel panels, visibly, that is 100 foot tall, It's a perfect cube, 100 foot on the, 100 feet on the side, that has inside three levels that retrace a different history of the landscape. There was a famous battle that was decisive for the country in the back. And on the top floor, it turns out that the walls are actually transparent because they're dotted with tiny holes. When you're inside, you see out, like there's no window.
The Bohr cube.
I don't know where Neuchâtel at the time.
Not then. No, I don't think that was there then.
This is an exhibition like a universal fair we do every 30 years or so. Where the country asks, why do we exist at all? Why do we still bury each other? And then we spend millions of dollars, and then we happy with a new identity.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
So in the case of, the reason why I asked about potassium, by the way, because that's one background of Dhamma, this collaboration of Bernabei, the same Bernabei. It's one background they definitely have. And if you have like a year or 2 years of data on that, you can at least rule out the possibilities of that thing is oscillating. Because you can just start with a gamma.
Yeah, I see exactly your point. I don't want to sound negative, but I'm not sure that's very much help to them because the modulation is at very low energy.
No, no, but that decay is a decay of potassium into excited state of argon. The thing that you're measuring is the gamma ray that goes from the excited to the ground state. But in the decay from potassium to argon, there are also 3 keV Auger electrons that are released. And this is what they measure. They are sensitive to that.
Is it a one-to-one relationship between the two?
Yeah.
I think the 1460 kV is 100% relative intensity, or close to 100%. But I'm not sure about the other one.
Whenever you see the gamma ray, there is an associated Auger electrons that are coming from the electron capture.
So now let me return the question to you. If they had the perfect detector to study that.
They have studied that, and they claim that they don't see oscillations
in the potassium.
Right, but it's actually it's. I think you, with your energy resolution, you might be able to do this measurement even better. But that was actually not my question. My question was, in the same way that you can tag this decay with the gamma rays, is there any isotopes that undergoes double beta decay and rather than decaying into the ground state and goes into an excited nuclear state, in which case you may be able to tag that. So you're tagging it with the bargain, but is there any way to maybe tag that reaction by seeing the decaying into the ground state?
This is a subfield on its own. A lot of people look for decays to the excited states instead of the ground states. Mm-hmm. Usually the transition rates are lower. In a few exceptions, they might be better, but that might not be elements that are easily manufactured into a detector. I don't think this applies to the xenon 136. A fraction of the decays would disintegrate to an excited state. And if this were to happen, it would be of interest to us only if it was a large amount, right? One half of them. If you go in the 10 to the minus 2 range, and we want to put a limit on sum of all the decays, that is, a few counts in 10 years, probably we wouldn't even see it. And that actually, thank you for asking me this question, because that is a major problem here. When you go into low background, you do whatever you want, you don't have statistics. You have 5 counts here, and that's all you got. So you have to be really smart in other ways to make sense of these 5 counts. Understanding how you obtain them, what else happens in a detector, and how these 5 counts correlate maybe with another line, this where this myth, we do a lot of that. But we are, no matter what, this is the largest detector you have, you can't get more statistics than what you have. The main problem is to know your background from an outside point of view. Like radon is visibly a problem. The detector is the most sensitive radon detector. You can build whatever you want on the side, but you will still need TPC itself telling you that your rates are low. So if you're after a decay channel that is a lower probability, you'll be even more statistics limited than for the main channel.
So there's some experiments that are looking at like precision measurements of the beta decay spectrum to get information about neutrinos. Can you make like similar limits on your two neutrino beta spectrum shape, or?
Your question touches two points. The first one is that the limits haven't been very competitive so far. The best limit from that field, this is called endpoint decay, or beta endpoint, was with tritium, and they have a limit of order of 2,000 milliEV or 2 EV. And this experiment is expanding on a larger scale. It's called Catrain now. They have a spectrometer that's 40 meters long. You may have seen that in the news when they were trying to go through villages in Germany with that detector. And I think the goal is to improve by an order of magnitude at 0.2.
Okay.
So if they're fast enough, they will be competitive with double beta decay. On the other hand, I think we would all welcome to have data that is compatible between two different, this is a totally different process that you look at. If really the effective mass of neutrinos is what you think with double beta decay, zero, then you should see it's a different linear combination that you find in the endpoint, but you should see something compatible.
Well, I mean, for one thing, that probes Dirac mass in general, right? And this doesn't. So, I mean, it's a very nice complementary measurement. Because, for example, if you don't see, if they see something and you don't see, not only do we nail the mass, we also nail the Dirac.
Yeah. And the other component of your question, in my opinion, was actually how well we know the endpoint. This is obtained through a very complex, dedicated apparatus that measures the mass of the ground states. So we know ours by precision of, if I remember correctly, 0.07 kV. It's 2457.7, something like that. So it's a very precise measurement. So I don't think we have a doubt on the value of the Q value. The question is really your energy scale.
It's also true that they're complementary in the sense that you could see something and they could get a bound which is lower than yours, and it could be consistent, because if there had been a heavy sterile neutrino that was, you only get something linear in the mass in your matrix element in limit, the neutrino is very light. But if you had a very massive sterile neutrino, and what your mass would really be the Fermi momentum squared divided by the mass of the real neutrino. So you could be seeing things that they wouldn't see in this.
I do that all the time.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's like, thank you.